Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The speech was barely covered. The speaker was retired, but just. When longtime Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor took the floor at Georgetown University this month for a speech to corporate attorneys, she was typically cool-headed, but unusually forceful on a touchy subject in Washington these days, the balance of power and the independence of the judiciary. In a time of angry congressmen and expanding executive authority, O'Connor's message was essentially, back off. When courts are pressured, she said, dictatorships can grow. We should avoid these ends, she said, by avoiding these beginnings. A Supreme Court justice, even recently retired, says a lot when she says a little. Justices have had death threats. The president's war on terror has brought fundamental rights into question. With a Congress largely bowing to the executive, the role of the courts is front and center. This hour on Point, the separation of powers and Sandra Day O'Connor's warning on the independence of the courts. You can join the conversation. How do you see the health of the balance of power in Washington these days? Are we avoiding the beginnings of trouble? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We go first to Washington. NPR's Nina Totenberg was one of the few reporters who heard Sandra Day O'Connor's speech. I asked her to describe the setting when the former justice spoke.
This was a speech she gave for the Corporate Law Institute, which is a group of lawyers who represent the largest corporations in America for the most part, and they were having their annual meeting at Georgetown University, and she gave a speech there.
There were not cameras rolling. There wasn't even tape rolling, as far as we can tell. But you describe what she delivered as unusually forceful and forthright. What was she focused on?
There was, in fact, tape. Georgetown University made a taped record of this speech, but it has not released it, I presume, at her request. And she has not released her text either. So I have become the paper of record, as it were, because I was there taking notes, and the press was invited. I just happened to be one of the few people who actually showed up.
Good for you, and good for your notes. What was the heart of Justice, retired now, Justice O'Connor's complaint, warning?
Well, she said that attacks on the judiciary by some Republican leaders pose a direct threat to our constitutional freedoms. She said, you know, we aren't doing our jobs unless we sometimes make governors and presidents and Congresses angry. The nation's founders wrote repeatedly, she said, that without an independent judiciary to protect individual rights from the other branches of government, those rights and privileges wouldn't amount to a thing. Mm. She said that the founders of our republic knew that statutes and constitutions don't protect judicial independence. People do. And then she took aim at former House GOP leader Tom DeLay and at Texas Senator John Cornyn. She didn't name either one of them, but she quoted things that they have said in a very disparaging way, suggesting that they were clearly seeking to threaten the judiciary, both with their official actions. Referring to, for example, Senator Cornyn, she said, it gets worse. Death threats against judges are increasing. It doesn't help when a high-profile senator suggests that there may be a connection between violence against judges and decisions that the senator disagrees with. She went on to observe that there have been a lot of suggestions lately for so-called judicial reforms, recommendations for the mass impeachment of judges, stripping the courts of jurisdiction, cutting judicial budgets to punish offending judges. Any of these might be debatable, she said, as long as they are not retaliation for decisions that political leaders disagree with. I, said O'Connor, am against judicial reforms driven by nakedly partisan reasoning.
Nina, let me just bring in a piece of tape here, if I may, for a moment. One of the comments she was responding to, you report, were comments made by Tom DeLay, the former Republican leader in the House, at the
Justice Sunday last year.
And this was after the Supreme Court had gone against DeLay and Congress in the Terri Schiavo case. Let's listen to a little bit of what Tom DeLay had to say at Justice Sunday that Justice O'Connor then responded to.
We will look at an arrogant, out-of-control, unaccountable judiciary that thumb their nose at Congress and the President when given the jurisdiction to hear this case anew and make a determination they chose not to participate.
He went on to say the time will come for the men responsible for this to answer for their behavior. Well, it was a woman who responded to that. What was Justice O'Connor's remark there?
Well, speaking of the Terri Schiavo case, she said that the federal courts had applied Congress's one-time-only statute about Schiavo as it was written, not as the congressman might have wished it were written. The response to this flagrant display of judicial restraint, she said, was that the congressman blasted the courts.
And then Sandra Day O'Connor, lifelong Republican, moved on to use this word dictatorship. What was the context for that?
Well, she went through all the countries that she's worked with and that others in the federal judiciary have worked with to try to make an independent judiciary, and the times it has succeeded and the times it has failed. And speaking of developing countries and former communist countries that have ended up with a dictatorship kind of government because there was no independent judiciary, she referred, for example, to Zimbabwe as a country that was a nightmarish dictatorship. And then she said, we must be ever vigilant against those who would strong-arm the judiciary into adopting their preferred policies. It takes a lot of degeneration before a country becomes a Zimbabwe, but we should avoid these ends by avoiding these beginnings.
This is strong language even from a retired justice. You describe this as unusually forceful and forthright. What's really at the heart of this? What's going on here, Nina?
Well, I think that she and others have become increasingly alarmed at what they see as assaults on the independence of the judiciary. They understand that a lot of these subjects are controversial and they expect to be disagreed with. The point at which they, and she in particular, is drawing the line is what she sees as an attempt by, at the moment, Republican leaders in Congress, or some of them, to punish the judiciary for the judiciary's official acts, its judgment, to get back at it, to take away its power, or to punish it by, for example, taking away its money. And that is the whole idea of an independent judiciary. And that's why, for example, the Constitution doesn't allow Congress to cut the salary of federal judges. That, along with life tenure, is supposed to insulate the federal judiciary from the waves of angst that may occur in the body politic. And I think she's very concerned that some of those barriers that are supposed to protect the judiciary are being stripped away, or at least that there are attempts to strip it away.
We think of the Supreme Court sort of plowing on aloof and secure in its quarters there in Washington, but she's saying something very different here. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg spoke to a related issue recently. She was out of the country in South Africa. Can you share that with us?
Well, she was in early February, she was in South Africa, and she gave a speech about the use of foreign law in Supreme Court opinions. Now, there is no Supreme Court case that I know of in which a decision by a foreign court has been deemed to be controlling of American law, but very often Supreme Court justices in writing an opinion will cite decisions of other courts in other countries to sort of buttress their argument. See, so-and-so in England and France and whatever agrees with me. There's a healthy disagreement on the court about whether that's appropriate or not. And she was speaking on the side that says, we should do this. We should not be operating in a vacuum. We should recognize what, take a look at other countries and see what we can learn from them too, not that they're controlling. But there have been attempts in Congress, or at least proposed pieces of legislation or resolutions, to either impeach judges if they cite foreign law or to bar them from citing foreign law. And she says in her speech, although I doubt the current measures will garner sufficient votes to pass, it is disquieting that they have attracted sizable support. And one not so small concern, they fuel the irrational fringe. A personal example, says Justice Ginsburg. The U.S. Supreme Court Marshal alerted Justice O'Connor and me last year to a web posting on a chat site. It opened, "Okay, commandos, here is your first patriotic assignment, an easy one. Supreme Court Justices Ginsburg and O'Connor have publicly stated that they use foreign laws and rulings to decide how to rule on American cases," says the blog, being quoted. "This is a huge threat to our Republican constitutional freedom. If you are what you say you are and not armchair patriots, then those two justices will not live another week."
Wow, that's as personal and direct as it gets with the death threat that reported there by Justice Ginsburg. Nina Totenberg, the New York Times has looked out on all this recently and said, look, on national security, Congress has abdicated to a president who's pumping up presidential power. Now it's the court's turn to step in and keep the separation of powers, the balance of powers. Do you see Justice O'Connor speaking to this in her remarks? And if so, how loud a warning bell is she ringing?
Well, I think she was ringing a warning bell, but not to the court, really. She was ringing a warning bell to the legal profession and to the public, saying, if you want us to be an independent arbiter, you can't allow us to be the subject of this kind of threat. We understand that what we do makes people very, very angry sometimes, and we expect to be the subject of legitimate debate, but not death threats, not threats to take away the power of the courts and to dismember, in her view, the constitutional protections for an independent judiciary. That, I think, was her warning. If you want a system of an independent judiciary to protect whatever rights you hold dear, you have to have a judiciary that's somewhat insulated from popular passion.
And if you don't want a dictatorship, avoid these ends by avoiding these beginnings. Nina Totenberg, thanks for sharing with us what you heard.
Thank you.
Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent. Listeners, you can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We'll be right back with more views. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Funding for On Point comes in part from Harvard Summer School, helping students improve language skills through 36 courses in 15 foreign languages. Classes begin June 26th, summer.harvard.edu.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Sandra Day O'Connor's warning on the separation of powers and the independence of the courts in a time of very assertive executive authority, in a time of very angry politics. You can join the conversation. What do you think? How is the health of the balance of powers in Washington looking to you these days? And what does it mean when a sober Republican like Sandra Day O'Connor warns of imbalance, of threats to the judiciary? Are you open to a more powerful presidency in a time of security threats? Is the Bush White House pushing its power too far? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am joined from Washington now by Stephen Salzberg, professor of law at George Washington Law School. He co-chairs the American Bar Association's Commission on Sentencing, Corrections, and Reentry, served as deputy assistant attorney general in the criminal division of the Department of Justice. Stephen Salzberg, thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Also with us from Washington, Stuart Taylor, weekly opinion columnist for the National Journal, contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. He's covered the Supreme Court for more than 20 years, has his own legal background. Stuart Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Stuart, first to you. You've got an article in the Atlantic Monthly, April edition, saying that the country is struggling with how to recalibrate now the balance between liberty and security. You write, the succession of claims by the Bush administration that the commander-in-chief has near dictatorial powers to wage war against terrorists are really mixing things up. How do you see Sandra Day O'Connor's remarks in light of your assertions there?
Interestingly, she didn't seem to address what I was concerned with there. What I was concerned with there were what I think are overly sweeping claims of power by the Bush administration to act unilaterally, doing things such as detaining American citizens caught in America in military brigs, that sort of thing, and many others. She was addressing something quite different, frankly, and she was addressing attacks from Congress on the courts about cases like Terry Schiavo and gay rights and the death penalty, which is where this foreign law citation has come in. Now, I think the nexus between her complaint and my complaint is that if the courts are weakened by political attacks of any kind, They become a less potent potential check against presidential abuse of the president's powers.
Stephen Salzberg, we've seen over time in this country a kind of dynamic, a fluid quality to where power lies, which branch at any given moment. How do you see power flowing right now between the three branches? How do you see the balance?
I don't think there's any doubt that this is probably the strongest claim of executive power that the Bush administration has made, that we've experienced certainly in modern times and maybe ever. I think that Congress has basically been AWOL in trying to figure out what the appropriate balance between executive power and liberty is. And as a result, the only check on executive power has been the courts. And the courts have been quite a modest check. They've been very deferential. That's why you don't see the executive attacking the courts very much. It's very odd. You see Congress, which refuses to take on the executive, attacking the courts because the courts have a very hard time fighting back. It takes a retired justice to do it.
And here we see Senator O'Connor speaking, though, as Stuart Taylor says, there's all kinds of currents flowing through here. She may have been, and the things that she noted in particular were attacks from Congress. Stuart Taylor, you've written about the arguments for unilateral powers that the Bush administration has made, which are unusual. I wish you'd take us very quickly through those. How would you line up the major ones?
Well, for example, the president was advised by his then White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, now attorney general, before he invaded Iraq, that he didn't need congressional authorization. He could launch a gigantic invasion on his own. And now he eventually got congressional authorization. I think it was a political mandate, but that's a terribly dangerous idea that the president can have the whole war power. His lawyers have written any number of very broad sweeping claims of almost unlimited power to torture prisoners against the laws of the United States. They've backed off from that after an outcry to detain people without any form of due process. To create these military commissions that are going to be before the Supreme Court next week, and just out of whole cloth, ignoring the entire system of military and civilian courts when he could have gone to Congress. And you can go on down the list. Now, the president hasn't always used his claimed powers as outrageously as, for example, when 110,000 Japanese Americans were detained during World War II.
By FDR.
Yes, by FDR. But the claims he has made and his lawyers have made are almost limitless in the power, and they've been chopped back some by the Supreme Court. But I don't think the administration has any intention of becoming more accommodating or of consulting Congress when they think they can just do it themselves.
Stephen Salzberg, a lot in play here. The court will be looking at cases that impact on assertions of executive authority. Can you give us a quick thumbnail of what's going to come to the court, which will, from their little piece of the pool table, decide what check they put or do not put on the White House here?
Well, the first case, Stuart mentioned Hamdan, it's going to be argued next week, has two main parts to it, and it's going to be the court's next attempt to check or not the Bush administration. The first part is to decide whether a statute that was passed at the behest of the Senate, basically Senator Lindsey Graham and Carl Levin, John Kyle, mm-hmm. Said that all jurisdiction to review Guantanamo issues should rest in the D.C. Circuit. That should be exclusive jurisdiction. And the question is, does that statute apply to people like Hamdan who'd filed suits challenging the conditions of confinement and their treatment mm-hmm. prior to the enactment of the statute? If the court says that jurisdiction has been removed except as provided in the statute, that will greatly limit the power of federal courts to deal with Guantanamo issues. The second issue in the case relates to a treaty, whether or not the Geneva Convention apply, whether they're the Bush administration has to follow them in the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo. And that gets into questions that Stuart's already mentioned about whether or not international law governs what we do in the United States, whether international law needs to be recognized by Congress in order to become part of American law. And a lot of people are watching it because the United States has been very quick to say that the Geneva Conventions don't apply in circumstances where most other countries think they do.
Stuart Taylor, a lot on the line here and a lot coming before the court. All the way back at the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton wrote that the judiciary will always be the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution because it doesn't have the sword, it doesn't have the power of the purse. But now we have Justice Ginsburg talking openly about death threats, a reference to them by Sandra Day O'Connor. Is it possible that the court feels afraid.
I think there have been developments that have thrown some fear into federal judges across the country, including the murder in a judge's home of her husband and mother, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. In Chicago.
And a lot of judges are asking for security. Now, threats against Supreme Court justices are nothing new. After Roe versus Wade in 1973, there were plenty of threats against Harry Blackmun. And I'm not aware of any evidence that their frequency has increased, but it's always a scary thing. Now, I frankly think that when Justice Ginsburg associated those threats with people who have been criticizing the court on legitimate grounds for some of its decisions, that was a rather unfortunate smear on Justice Ginsburg's part, in my view, of the people in Congress who are criticizing the court on foreign law grounds. She also associated them with the Dred Scott decision. I don't think every critic of the court deserves to be lumped together with death threats.
Of course, you have to wonder exactly how to interpret Tom DeLay at Justice Sunday saying the time will come for the men responsible for this to answer for their behavior.
I think DeLay's rhetoric and Senator
John Cornyn?
Cornyn's rhetoric, which I think that was more a slip on his part. Mm-hmm. Delays seem more important. That kind of rhetoric might justify what Justice Ginsburg said, but the people she was associating with death threats were not Cornyn and DeLay. They were, or not them particularly, they were other members of Congress and who have criticized the court for the rather exotic practice of saying that the content of the United States Constitution should be informed in part by what foreign courts are deciding now.
I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Bill's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're hearing it all. What do you think?
I think you couldn't have a more relevant topic. You started off the hour by saying, is there a balance of powers? And the answer is no. Congress has made itself irrelevant. Both Congress and the President have violated collectively their oaths of office. They have not upheld their oaths to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. I think Sandra Day O'Connor is right on the money. This is a frightening development. It has been a frightening development. You've got a President that is out of hand. He decides what rules he's going to obey, and he decides what he's not going to obey. He makes up his own guidelines. And you have a Congress that refuses to slap him on the knuckles. I find this very discouraging. It's a very tragic development, especially considering that there's no public outrage.
Well, we've got Senator Day O'Connor speaking up at least from her perspective and her vantage. Bill,
thanks
for your call. I want to turn to Los Angeles and Lori Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, where she teaches law and terrorism. She's also director of the Center for Ethical Advocacy at Loyola, a former federal prosecutor. Lori, thanks for being with us again. We just heard from you a few days ago. It's good to have you back.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
So here's Sandra Day O'Connor in particular doing this. Now, Stuart Taylor and Steven Salzberg have pointed out she's retired, so she's got a new freedom to speak. And yet, this has never been a justice who sort of threw things out willy-nilly. This is a very carefully sort of calculated public figure. What do you see in her remarks?
I think people really have to listen because, as was noted, she's not a raging liberal. You cannot forget how she got on the Supreme Court. She got on the Supreme Court because she was a Republican legislator, a conservative. She got on that court. She voted 75% of the time with Rehnquist while she was on the court.
Ronald Reagan's appointment.
She was Ronald Reagan's appointment. Bush v. Gore, she's responsible for Bush being in the office. So I find it troubling when people now don't want to listen to her and just write it off as some type of liberal politics. It's not that. As both of your guests have said, this is a very serious issue because it's not just Sandra Day O'Connor. You talk to judges all the way down through the trial court, and they feel under the gun as well.
Is this president going too far?
I think the president has gone too far. I agree that in the war on terrorism, the president has, as Sandra Day O'Connor has said, thinks he has a blank check. And no president has a blank check when it comes to the rights of the citizens. But the president here, just labeling things that he's doing it in the name of the commander-in-chief, is going ahead and doing wiretaps that, as Congress should be taking note of, taking actions against enemy combatants without providing them with any rights. These are very troubling developments, but the most troubling one is to just go after the judges who disagree with them.
Stephen Salzberg, in this country, we have always seen, as I look at history, the executive authority pumped up in times of conflict, vulnerability, challenge, war in particular. So is this so different?
It is a little bit different. The former Chief Justice Rehnquist, wrote a book about the role of the courts, the Supreme Court, in times of conflict, and basically concluded that courts were deferential, that they recognized that they didn't have the information, they didn't have the ability to react quickly the way the executive does, and that basically they would defer. But as we look back in history, and Stuart mentioned the Japanese relocation, there's, I think, a general agreement among a lot of historians that when we look at the exercise of executive power in times of armed conflict, we often find, in retrospect, that the executive has gone too far. And the courts may not be able to stop that in the moment, but they, right now, they're the only place to go because, as we've said and your calling said, Congress just isn't performing any check on the executive at the moment.
Laurie Levinson, we see people, though, reaching way back in history, back to Abraham Lincoln, to say, look, presidents have had to take charge before. So what about the Lincoln example, habeas corpus and all the rest? Is President Bush so different from Honest Abe?
Oh, I think he is different. Don't forget that at least Honest Abe didn't think that his war would go on forever in the country. And the president just yesterday, I believe, in a speech sort of said this is somewhat indefinite. The other thing is that I think that this president is taking it to new levels. Not only is there the issue of the Guantanamo Bay detainees and what their status might be, but there's also the question of whether this president, when he doesn't like what the judges are doing, will pull people right out of the court system, American citizens, and treat them in an alternative system as enemy combatants, and do it really in retaliation for what the courts are doing. I think that makes it different.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sandra's calling from Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hi, Sandra. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm wondering, and I'd like to ask your guest to consider, I'm not in favor of what DeLay did. I think this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the population of a country in general, I think an awful lot of people are very unhappy with the court because of their choice to get involved in the 2000 election. And when they were previously very much for states' rights, here they turned around and made a decision that was very, very controversial and still is, and has made a lot of people very unhappy and very untrusting of them.
So here's the issue. Here's the issue of trust put to the court itself. Stuart Taylor, how about it? We've got critics on the right, but then you look back to 2000, critics from the left. What about the general standing of the court these days in the public eye? That is, of course, key to its power. Does it have it?
Well, it's interesting because, of course, the attacks that we've heard lately have been coming from the right. All the people who were attacking the court in 2000 are now rallying around it. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was part of the majority that put Bush in the Oval Office, and now she's a little bit of a latter-day liberal heroine in a limited way. So people attack the court when it does things they don't like, and 2000 was a little bit of an aberration in that it was offending liberals so much. But the court's popularity ratings, they get rated too, in terms of approval, do you have confidence, have been somewhat down in recent years. Now, they didn't dive immediately after the 2000 election. They dove among Democrats and soared among Republicans. But in general, I think that there is a concern that if for whatever reason the court's popularity rating, the public respect for the court, continues to sink, it will become more timid about checking unwarranted presidential assertions of power, for example.
Laurie Levinson, do you see a slow-motion showdown in the works here? Because you say Congress is abdicating, many say, so are the courts and the White House now sort of staring at each other?
Yes, and what really troubles me is that one of the reasons, I think a key reason that the court's popularity is dropping is the anti-court rhetoric, that instead of respect for the court's decision, it could be disagreement, but respectful disagreement, there are these wholesale attacks. And I think Congress, frankly, is so wrapped up in its own politics that it doesn't even see the issue, that it doesn't come in and recognize that the court is doing what its job is under what our framers expected, trying to put a check on the president. It's a particular concern, I think, now when you have the same party who controls the White House, controls the Congress and is making the appointments to the Supreme Court. It's hard to say that we should then criticize the Supreme Court for trying to provide some type of check.
We've got a lot more to look at here. Lori Levinson, Stuart Taylor, Stephen Salzberg, please stand by. We're talking about retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's warning on the separation of powers and the independence of the courts. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Sandra Day O'Connor's warning on the separation of powers and the independence of the courts in a time of very assertive executive authority and very angry politics. You can join us. What's it mean when Justice O'Connor makes a cool and careful reference to dictatorship? With Congress more or less accepting President Bush's growing power, is it the court's job to be the check and balance? How strange is it to you to hear of death threats to Supreme Court justices? How's the balance looking here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Loyola Law School by Lori Levinson, by Stephen Salzberg, professor of law at George Washington Law School in Washington, and by Stuart Taylor, weekly opinion columnist for the National Journal and contributing editor to Newsweek magazine. Kathy's calling right now from Middleburg, Virginia. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes. First of all, you're putting together a fabulous show, and it needs to be said, and bless you for saying it. My point simply is that given the massive authority of one branch of government over the others and the, let's say, the erosion of the balance of powers in the Constitution, the only bulwark that we have as citizens now is a free, honest, brave, and objective press. And to me, even more frightening than the takeover of the judiciary, if you will, by the Republican Party, are the scandals in the newsrooms at the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles, because if we can no longer trust the press, we have no weapon, we have no shield, we have no defense.
Well, we need to know clearly what's going on, but it's not as though Sandra Day O'Connor hasn't been reported on. Nina Totenberg got what you said out here in public.
I didn't mean it that way at all. What I meant was that what she said is perfect. What she said has been beautifully reported by Nina Totenberg, who's definitely one of the good guys. She deserves a medal, as do her colleagues. But I think we must also look at the role. We have three branches of government, but then we have the fourth estate.
We hear it, and we thank you for your call, Kathy. I mean, we hate to divide into good guys and bad guys. Lots of people have very serious concerns from many directions here, but the Constitution does stand right there. Stephen Salzberg, I wish you'd look for a moment just at the Padilla case with us. This is the so-called dirty bomb guy. And what was set aside there in the government's action, and what's been recovered in terms of rights and precedent?
Well, Padilla was one of the three Americans who were named American citizens who were named enemy combatants. When he first challenged his detention, he challenged it in the wrong court. And when he went to the United States Supreme Court, they said he brought his action in New York, and he should have brought it down in South Carolina, where he was in a Navy brig. The government maintained that it had the right to detain him as an enemy combatant forever.
An American citizen. And, I mean, for part of that time, kind of in a black hole, in a cell somewhere no one knew.
Exactly. And in the Supreme Court, in the Hamdi case, he was one of the other American citizens. Mm-hmm. His case was decided on the merits. The Supreme Court basically recognized the right of the president to detain someone. It imposed some procedural requirements, but it looked as though that the president would have the authority to detain an American citizen as an enemy combatant. Ultimately, before his case could be litigated through the courts again, the government decided to charge him in a criminal case in Miami with with crimes that were really unrelated to what they had alleged he'd been planning to do when they named him an enemy combatant. And he said, I want to still have this reviewed because if I win my criminal case, they're going to lock me up again anyway.
Mm-hmm. Laurie Levinson, are we losing rights as we wade into this so-called war on terror? Are they being stripped away in a significant long-term way?
Unquestionably. And the American public is not even blinking. I think we've been so scared by all the different alerts that the government put out. There are legitimate concerns about terrorists. But there has been this sort of pattern of whenever a major bill like a Patriot Act or now the second Patriot Act comes through or, you know, another big case, that there are scare alerts that go out to the public, and then we forget that now searches can take place under standards that we never had before, much lower standards, that the secret FISA court is being used for surveillance instead of the regular Article III court, that we are frankly losing rights that are much easier to lose than they are to get back.
Stuart Taylor, you write that George Bush prefers to act unilaterally, so much so, in fact, quoting you, that avoidance of oversight seems at times to be his principal goal. I mean, this is not just malicious. There is a view in Washington that says we have an unprecedented challenge here and we have to respond in unprecedented ways. Does that view comfortably or at all coexist with constitutional guarantees? And when there's a gap, what do we do about it as a country?
Well, I think it can coexist. I think when the threat level goes way up, and it went way up, or we became aware that it went way up after 9/11, it justifies more restrictive surveillance rules, for example, than when things are kind of placid and calm. For that reason, I think, and I may disagree with Laurie on this, I think the Patriot Act, by and large, is a very reasonable piece of legislation, rather incremental, not a dramatic change in our laws, and an appropriate one under the circumstances. What's scary to me about some of the things President Bush has said and asserted is that there's no limit to them. It's not a carefully calibrated, well, let's make an adjustment here and there and the other place. He is more or less saying, hey, we're at war and I'm the president and I have all of the war power. Congress has none of the war power. And so I'm going to run things the way I think we should. And we don't. Lincoln didn't say that. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during an emergency. And after the emergency passed, he went to Congress and said, by the way, here's what I did while you were away. Please ratify it. And Congress did. FDR, bad as the Japanese internment was, FDR, Congress ratified it. So I think Bush is what distinguishes him is that although we are in a very dangerous situation, I think there's no restraint in his willingness to assert executive power. It's just wholesale.
And you remind us that the framers gave Congress, not the commander-in-chief, despite the title, preeminence in matters of war, the Congress giving Congress the power to declare war, to, quote, define and punish offenses against the law of nations. But, of course, it can be grabbed in different directions. John's calling from Willsboro, New York. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. Back when he was president, President Eisenhower was severely criticized, I think mostly by liberals, for saying it was not his job to pass judgment on Supreme Court decisions, but to carry them out to the best of his ability as the chief executive.
How does that apply here, John?
It applies, I think, to President Bush's criticisms and Congress's criticisms of Supreme Court decisions and the independence of the Supreme Court.
So his job to carry them out, not to push back. Stephen Salzberg, what about the president's range or freedom to push back in extraordinary circumstances?
I don't think that President Bush has been disrespectful of the courts. I think he's been ignoring Congress. That he recognizes the courts have a role to play. He just has his Justice Department making the arguments that support broad claims of presidential power. He's carried out Supreme Court decisions even when he disagrees with them. He's actually been quite moderate in responding to decisions by the court that one might regard as a negative, not completely supportive. Basically, I think he's pretty satisfied with the state of the judiciary. After all, he's appointed a lot of judges. He's now appointed two Supreme Court justices who may, in fact, change the balance of power on the court in ways that he'll find support his administration. So I just don't think he's a president who has dissed the courts. He's dissed the Congress, but not the courts.
Laura Levinson, do you agree? And what difference do you think it will make on the courts to have Alito and Roberts there now? Senator Day O'Connor is speaking up, but she's off.
Well, I think in terms of who he's dissed, what we do know is that he's going outside of what Congress has passed. I mean, responding to Stewart's comment, you know, Stewart, we may agree on some of the provisions of the Patriot Act, but I think we would also agree that we'd be troubled by the NSA warrants, that he's now the president going outside of the Patriot Act, which he asked for all these changes, and when he doesn't like the powers that he has under that, he just goes ahead and orders his searches anyways under his commander-in-chief powers. In terms of what's going to happen with these new two Supreme Court justices, I think Stephen's absolutely right, which is these are appointments by Bush. We heard during the confirmation hearings that they believe in what they call the unitary executive, which many people interpret as increased power for the president. I don't see the direction going more in favor of the courts or Congress. I think it goes more towards the power of the president.
Saf is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Saf. You're on the air.
Good morning. I come from a third world country, and I see close parallels between what we are in now in terms of government and a third world country.
Why? How?
As I think one of your guests pointed out, that the people who are in the court system, and if the administration doesn't like them, it takes them out of the court system into parallel legal system. That's exactly what happens, for example, in Pakistan. I come from Pakistan originally. Mm-hmm. Now I'm a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a secular law, then there is Sharia law, mm-hmm. and then there is martial law. The main purpose is to inflict punishment, not to dispense justice. What distinguishes us as a society is the law and the application of law equal to all citizens, where the powerful cannot abuse the less powerful, and we are losing that. The one other characteristic of third world country is that they cannot tolerate opposition. They either label them as enemies or they mock them as idiots, as Belarus people. You probably recently mm-hmm. heard how they mm-hmm. treated their opposition. We are heading in that direction if we don't check ourselves. That's my point.
There's a warning from a U.S. citizen, but out of Pakistan. Saf, thanks very much for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Stuart Taylor, you put the question up. I mean, Laura Levinson says there's a lot on the line here, but Americans aren't blinking at what's going on. You asked the kind of rhetorical question, will we become habituated to creeping presidential autocracy? How seriously do you put the question?
I think it's a very serious, very worrisome. And part of the reason is the American public, by and large, polls show, is remarkably ignorant about what's in the Constitution. So if the president does something that's flatly inconsistent with the Constitution, not a whole lot of people out there are going to understand that he did that, particularly because our partisan divide is going to always have advocates on both sides of the issue and people listening to the ones they like and ignoring the ones they don't like. So there's a lot of need for checking by the other institutions, Congress, the judiciary, and the media, as was mentioned earlier. Mm. And to the extent that the other institutions either abdicate their powers, as I think Congress clearly has, or become weakened, as could happen to the courts if vituperative criticism gets out of control, or weakened in ways the press has been weakened. The press is very unpopular. There is some danger that President Bush or a successor might just say, I can do whatever I want and do it.
Richard's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm an attorney, and I guess I know a little bit about the law, maybe not much, but
we bet you know a lot. What do you think?
Well, I think a lot of the assumptions that are asserted by the president and are assumed by your law professors and all that are talking on this program miss a very important fact, and that is, do we even need the Patriot Act? If you look at the trial that's going on right now, isn't there a question that if the FBI had done their job properly and the FAA had done their job properly, and we had good police work, and it was done properly, could not 9/11 have been prevented? And we focused on our power grab by the executive branch instead of focusing on who's been fired at the FBI, what's been done to rectify the poor police work. That seems to me to be the underlying problem, and is person who defends criminal cases. I mean, you look at the Massawi case, and that appears to be a joke.
Richard, we hear it, and we followed that news as well. We appreciate your call. Stephen Salzberg, how about it? Stuart Taylor says it looks like there is an accumulation of power almost for its own sake here. Our caller Richard in South Carolina says the actual exercise of power may matter more than what's being grabbed and stored up. How do you look at that?
You know, when Janis Joplin sang Me and Bobby McGee, one of the lines in there was, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Yes,
that I always thought defined freedom in another country. Freedom in the United States always meant that you had a lot on the line, you had a lot to lose. And I think we don't hear people talking about that. There's very little leadership that speaks up and talks about individual rights, that says how important these constitutional rights are. It is true the American people are largely ignorant about the exact scope of their rights. But they do care. They care about free speech. They care about privacy. They care about a lot. Right now, they are lacking a leader. Anybody voicing on the other side that says, yeah, we have to protect America, but there are ways of protecting America that are consistent with our history of protecting liberty as well. Liberty and security are not antithetical to each other. They can go hand in hand, but it takes a leader who cares about both. And frankly, I don't see a leader on the Democratic side speaking up in a way that makes me happy and proud.
Lori Levinson, you point to the same thing. You say Americans aren't blinking at the kind of incipient stripping of rights. What makes Americans blink on this subject? What will? What might?
Well, I think your last caller hit something that has made Americans pay attention. You know, if they hadn't read the 9/11 Commission report, they're seeing it played out now in the Moussaoui trial. I think the American public's beginning to realize that there really were failures on the government's part that had nothing to do, probably very little to do, with a lack of power, but just more a lack of competence. So Americans don't pay attention to all the legal wrangling in Congress. I think they've become quite jaded by that. But when a big trial like this is happening and they wonder, you know, why is this the strategy of the government, more people seem to be paying attention.
Lori, we're going to be watching next week at the Hamdan trial. What should we look for in the outcome there on the court's independence, on the balance of power?
Well, as Stephen said, I think the real issue is going to be what range of rights are there? Is there an international component to the law here? You know, what are the standards of due process that we have here? The court jumping into the details of how we deal with somebody that we've labeled as an enemy combatant and we say that is outside of our regular legal system.
A lot to watch here and a tremendous amount on the line, all the way from security to fundamental rights. I'm very grateful to each of you for being with us. Lori Levinson at Loyola Law School joining us from Los Angeles. Lori, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Stuart Taylor with the National Journal and Newsweek magazine joining us from Washington. Mr. Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Stephen Salzberg, professor of law at George Washington Law School. Stephen Salzberg, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Download the On Point podcast and subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Vince Fairchild, Matt Odette, and Angel Cozzelli, our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.